Some crimes are so heartbreaking or shocking, they change laws, change society, or even earn the label crime of the century. But the stories that made headlines in decades past aren't necessarily remembered today. I'm Amber Hunt, a journalist and author, and in each episode of this show, I'll examine a case that's maybe lesser known today, but was huge when it happened. This is Crimes of the Centuries. In the Library of Congress's repository of seminal American historical artifacts, under the file name William Gabaitis, is a single letter. It's dated November 5th, 1935. In the cursive, slanted scrawl of a fifth-grade boy, Billy Gabaitis wrote to inform the Minersville, Pennsylvania school district that he could not be a part of their public school morning ritual anymore. Addressed to our school directors, the missive read, quote, "Dear sirs, I do not salute the flag because I have promised to do the will of God. That means that I must not worship anything out of harmony with God's law. In the 20th chapter of Exodus is stated, thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image, nor bow down to them, nor serve them, for I, the Lord thy God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children, unto the third and fourth generation of them that hate me. I am a true follower of Christ. I do not salute the flag, not because I do not love my country, but I love my country and God more, and I must obey his commandments. Your pupil, Billy Gabaitis," end quote. 10-year-old Billy could not have known it, but he had just tossed a hand grenade onto a battlefield. It would take 8 years for the dust to settle and for him and his sister Lillian and their similarly inclined sixth-grade friend, Edmund Wasluski, to make the First Amendment truly reflect what the Founding Fathers intended. It would be argued by some that Billy and Lillian, poor old Eddie is kind of lost to history, were just doing what their deeply devout parents had told them to do, that they had been indoctrinated by twice-weekly required church attendance, once-weekly Bible studies, and full-time existence devoted to their faith and friends down at the Kingdom Hall. The children would deny that parental influence as long as they both lived. They would say that their family had always lived a Bible-centered life. They would maintain it was all Billy's idea and that Lillian, shamed that she hadn't thought of it herself, joined him. They would say it was not meant to be a protest or a big public deal. It was just what they believed, that saluting the flag was, in fact, an act of wrongful idolatry, and that God had been very, very specific about that. See Commandments number 1 and 2, notably ahead of Don't Kill Other People. The first, thou shalt have no other gods before me. The second, thou shalt not worship graven images. Walter and Ruth Gabaitis, who had 4 other children, would support Billy and Lillian as they fought for their right to not stand and salute the American flag. They would support them as they fought through several layers of federal court until they got to the United States Supreme Court. And they would be there when they made a return trip to the Supreme Court 3 years later for good measure. Because they were no ordinary children. They were Jehovah's Witnesses, and they believed, as only children can, that God would not let an injustice prevail, that he would fix this, and they would no longer be criminals before they hit puberty. Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by Home Chef. So we just got back from vacation, and honestly, one of the best parts was not having to figure out dinner every night.
Seriously, someone else was making the decisions, and we just showed up and ate. It was magical.
Now we're home, and I'm already dreading the return of what do you want to eat for dinner game.
That's exactly why we're using Home Chef. They deliver fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience.
You can pick from over 30 meals each week, and they've got everything. Classic meal kits, 30-minute recipes, oven-ready options, microwave meals, even a family menu.
They've also got new 5-ingredient meals that are basically my love language. Just 5 fresh, pre-portioned ingredients and dinner's done. Plus, users of leading meal kits have rated Home Chef number 1 in quality, convenience, value, taste, and recipe ease.
That's a long list. For a limited time, Home Chef is offering my listeners 50% off and free shipping for your first box, plus free dessert for life. Go to homechef.com/COTC.
That's homechef.com/COTC for 50% off your first box and free dessert for life.
Homechef.com/COTC. Must be an active subscriber to receive free dessert. The story of the Gabaitis children is not flashy. This is Lillian explaining what Billy did in a video posted by the Robert H. Jackson Center.
He came home one day and said, "I stopped saluting." And he said, "The teacher tried to put up my arm, but I held onto my pocket, and she couldn't put up my arm, you know." And I thought, oh my goodness, I have to take my own stand. I'd been kind of a chicken before that. And so the next day I went to the teacher and said, "Miss Schofstall," and I explained what I was going to do and why. And I was prepared for a recrimination. And she said, "Lillian, oh, you are a dear child." But not the class. When they saw, oh, they were so angry at me. And when I came to school, they said, "Here comes Jehovah," and the pebbles were flying. But I didn't care.
This decision to sit instead of stand, to keep your arm lowered, took place in the public school system of Minersville, a coal town of about 10,000 people, 90% of whom were Catholic. Walter Gabaitis' family were originally Lithuanian Catholics and relative newcomers to Minersville. Ruth was Pennsylvania Dutch, and her family had been in the region for 200 years. Walter and Ruth adopted the more conservative faith of the Jehovah's Witnesses sometime in the early 1930s when Lillian, the firstborn, was still quite young. The denomination was a relatively new one. It had been founded in Pittsburgh in the 1870s as an offshoot of the Adventist movement by Charles Taze Russell. The steel town was 250 miles due west of Minersville. Russell may not have intended to found a new faith. He had simply organized a Bible study group, and that grew into the International Bible Students Association, which by 1910 grew to number about 50,000. Russell's successor, Franklin Rutherford, changed the name to Jehovah's Witnesses in 1931. Jehovah was a Hebrew name for God in some translations of the Bible. So yeah, in 1935, when the two Gabaitis children went rogue, the sect was officially only 4 years old. The doctrine has many strictures, and while I'm not here to teach religion and would be woefully unqualified to do so anyway, I can at least present a few helpful facts about their beliefs. The Jehovah's Witnesses' uncompromising interpretation of the Bible means, among many things, that they believe it to be historically and scientifically true. They believe Jesus is his only son, but that he was not crucified on a cross, but on a stake, thus their rejection of the cross as a sacred symbol. They believe God is too kind and merciful to allow people to go to hell for eternity, but the number who will live forever with him in heaven as king priests will number only 144,000. The rest of the faithful will live peacefully on a paradise earth. They do not believe in participation in the military as active combatants and thus are, in most instances, allowed to be conscientious objectors. Per the Bible, they are to love one another, beat their swords into plowshares, and be no part of the world. They believe that their faith requires them to preach to others in a most vigorous way, hence their constant work on the streets, going door to door, handing out their watchtower literature, hoping to engage others in talking about the tenets of the Bible. In one of her last interviews, Lillian said she'd been going door to door to preach since she was 8. Born in 1923, that means she started in 1931, the very year that the Witnesses got their formal designation. They were, and still are, a small segment of American religious life. According to the Journal of Contemporary Religion, they have 9 million members worldwide, In the United States, they now have 12,000 congregations. That said, the journal also reports that they are the most rapidly growing religious movement in the Western world. Islam, by the way, is the world's fastest growing, with 1.9 billion adherents identifying as Muslim. Christianity is still the largest, with 2.3 billion believers. Back to that moment when the 5th and 7th graders in the largely Catholic Minersville classrooms met the faith, maybe for the first time, head on.
Yes, I was scared. I didn't know if I should stand or sit. These days I would stand respectfully, but those days I thought, what will I do, which is the right thing to do? And I sat, and that made it worse.
Lillian had been the class president, a popular girl. Now she was ostracized in every manner a seventh grader could muster. Hard, yes, but that's what Jehovah asked of her. It was not too much. The Gabaitis family, which ran the town's economy grocery and lived above the store, were equally maltreated, losing customers who felt the family was un-American. That was hard to figure, as Walter had extended credit, much to his own detriment, during the Depression so that local folks who were suffering could feed their families. Many times, he was never repaid. After the kids took their stand, that is, by taking their seat, the school superintendent, Charles Rudebush, tried to reason with Walter about his children's boycott. Neither man was willing to give an inch. Peter Irons, a legal scholar, explained in his book, The Courage of Their Convictions, that flag salute ceremonies started in 1898 when New York, reacting to the U.S. declaring war on Spain, passed the first mandatory law requiring Americans to visibly honor the flag. A few states followed suit. The American Legion soon hopped on board to get all states to pass such legislation. Joining them in this showy patriotism were the veterans of foreign wars, the daughters of the American Revolution, and the Ku Klux Klan. Writes Irons, quote, by 1935, 18 states had enacted flag salute statutes, and hundreds of local school boards in other states had voted to compel all students to participate in the ceremony, end quote. In short, the matter was what we might call today trending. So no, it wasn't just the children at the school who objected to Billy and Lillian's brave decision. The Minersville School District met on November 6th with the aim of taking on only this question. They were not the first to address the question of requiring children to salute the flag. Some Mennonite children had balked as early as 1918, then faced expulsion. A smattering of other Jehovah's Witnesses, most visibly a kid named Carlton Nichols in Lynn, Massachusetts, had also declined to salute the flag after Rutherford, their leader, had backed his German parishioners who refused to give homage to Hitler in a similar salute in 1933. The Gabaitis children knew about Carlton and how he had been expelled for his stand. They'd read it in the newspapers and talked about it at the Kingdom Hall. Now, a point that should be made here is that, unlike today, when school children traditionally are asked to place the right hand over their hearts to pledge allegiance, in the 1930s, the practice involved an actual salute, fingers to forehead, and then an unfolding of the arm upward, the palm extended downward. Are you picturing it? Yeah, it's a gesture we largely consider repulsive today. Anyway, when the Minersville School Board met that November evening, Walter Gabaitis had his turn to speak. He cited the same chapter of Exodus that his son had, the one about graven images, and he said, as Irons put it, that, quote, the flags of nations were images of Satan, who ruled the secular governments of the world, end quote. The board was unmoved. It unanimously voted to require all students in the district to salute the flag, and if they refused, they'd be dealt with accordingly. Rudebush then expelled the three errant children. Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by Cornbread. We've been back from vacation for like 5 minutes, and I already missed the do nothing, drink something fruity vibe.
Right? But now we've got these cornbread hemp THC seltzers, and they're kind of giving us that vacation feeling, even on a Tuesday.
Exactly. One of my favorite things is to crack open a blueberry breeze while we're sitting outside on the back deck. It is the fastest way I can think of to instantly feel like we're back on the beach.
I'm all about the salted watermelon. Just the right balance of refreshing and chill, like a poolside drink without the pool.
Finally, a THC seltzer that tastes and feels amazing and is only 30 calories with 5 grams of sugar, so I don't feel like I'm wrecking my day.
Each can has 5 milligrams of THC, which is enough to relax you without turning you into a statue. And no synthetics, just pure THC and all natural ingredients.
Whether we're winding down or trying to hang on to that vacation mood, these are perfect. No alcohol, no hangover, just good vibes.
Right now, Crimes of the Centuries listeners can save 30% off their first order and enjoy free shipping on orders over $75. Head to cornbreadhemp.com/COTC and use code COTC at checkout.
That's cornbreadhemp.com/COTC, code COTC. Cornbread Hemp, this is the good life.
So good.
For a few weeks, the Gabaitis children were homeschooled. Their school-age cousins would bring home the textbooks and the worksheets, and the kids would keep up with the grade-level curriculum. Lillian, at 12, still went out to do her weekly door-to-door proselytizing. In one case, she recounted in the Irons book, a mob formed to test her resilience. It was a Sunday, and apparently the local churches had let their parishioners out early to confront the witnesses as they worked the streets. A group was gathering on the street across from where Lillian was on the porch of a woman's house when the police drove up and told her to get in the patrol car. Then they drove her to the firehouse. She remembered being punched, and the group, now acting like some kind of vigilante mob, trying to break into the firehouse to get to her. Her family and other witness families had also been out witnessing, and they, likewise, were picked up and taken to the firehouse. Then they were jailed. Not the mob, the families who had been out trying to explain their religion to others. Then Walter and Ruth were warned about what would happen if their children did not return to their classrooms and comply. John Q. Barrett, a law expert speaking in a PBS documentary, explained that children who didn't salute the flag could be
expelled from school if they refused, and their parents then to become criminally liable for their children's truancy.
That potentially meant more jail time. Oh, and one more thing.
They would get a letter from the school board saying, if you are not with a proper teacher, you will be sent to a reformatory. Oh, what a horror story.
In short order, fellow witnesses Paul and Verna Jones set up a school 30 miles away for the Minersville scofflaws. Paul built a schoolroom in his house, knocking out the wall between his dining and living rooms to do so. Walter Gabaitis used his grocery delivery truck as a school bus, trucking all of the Kingdom Hall's children to and fro. The teacher the families employed was not a witness, Lillian would later say, just a professional educator who didn't like that children were being thrown out of school for such nonsense. At times, like in the heart of winter, the children lived with the Joneses' neighbors, 3 to a bed. The school's attendance stood around 40. The taunting did not stop. The little town's ugliness grew.
Then another time, the local clergyman told his parishioners, you need to boycott their grocery store as a recrimination. The business just went down. Oh, the store was so empty, it was horrible. When it came time to pay the mortgage, well, my aunt was a devout Catholic, but she said, family is family, and she loaned Dad the money. In time, as time went by, people resented being told where to buy their groceries.
Meanwhile, Walter had already decided he was not about to go down without a fight. With the help of the sex headquarters in Brooklyn and the American Civil Liberties Union Council, he filed suit in federal district court in Philadelphia on May 3, 1937. A tiny aside here for those inclined to research further, the family name is Gabaitis, spelled G-O-B-I-T-A-S. A clerical error in the legal filings changed the A to an I, G-O-B-I-T-I-S. It is how the case is recorded in American history, error intact. Back to Walter. His children, the complaint read, had been deprived of their constitutional rights, specifically freedom of speech and freedom of religion, as well as the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment. The lawyers for the school board shot back that religion had no part in this, that their flag ceremony was a secular one, and the purpose was to inculcate patriotism in their charges. Lillian and Billy testified at trial, something that impressed Judge Albert Maris, a Quaker appointed by Franklin Roosevelt. Maris ultimately ruled that the children's beliefs were their own and could not, quote, even remotely prejudice or imperil the safety, health, morals, property, or personal rights of their fellows, end quote. He didn't really address the larger constitutionality issues, but cited the Pennsylvania Constitution that protected rights of conscience. The school board appealed to the U.S. Court of Appeals in Philadelphia. As you know, the legal process can sometimes take a lot of time, and it was 18 months later when the court, in a scathing opinion, unanimously upheld Judge Maris's ruling. William S. Clark, the judge who was most incensed, was notably a Republican and had been appointed by Calvin Coolidge. The compulsory salute laws and this school board's imposition of it, he wrote, quote, happens to be abhorrent to the particular love of God of the little girl and boy now seeking our protection, end quote. So no, you can't make them salute. You have to let them back in school. But Walter wasn't the only stubborn man in Minersville. With the support of those big-name patriotic groups like the American Legion and the KKK, the Minersville School Board went ahead and appealed one more time to the U.S. Supreme Court. The matter was heard on April 25, 1940. 6 months earlier, Hitler had invaded Poland. The ACLU offered up a Harvard professor to argue that the children's First Amendment rights to free speech had been breached. Then the Jehovah's Witnesses had Rutherford, their leader, who also happened to be a lawyer, press the constitutional protection to freely practice the religion of one's choice. Lillian and Billy and their parents had been in attendance, given a first-class lesson in American jurisprudence for free. It had gone very well. Of course, no decision was made that day. Courts move slower than molasses. So the Gabaitis family went home to Minersville. 3 months after the SCOTUS hearing, on June 3, 1940, as the British were that day heroically rescuing their troops from the shores of Dunkirk, the Supreme Court published its decision. Lillian remembered that she and her mother were in the kitchen upstairs, and her brother, Billy, and her father were downstairs working in the store. The radio crackled.
There was a newscast in Washington today in the Flaxseed case. There was a ruling of 8-1. Against Jehovah's Witnesses. Oh, couldn't believe it. We ran downstairs to the store and told Bill and Dad they were equally aghast. That's when it was open season on Jehovah's Witnesses.
Only Justice Harlan Fiske Stone had dissented. What had happened? This was a court full of deep-thinking libertarian titans like Felix Frankfurter, William O. Douglas, and Hugo Black, though some thought of them as good old-fashioned liberals. As with every justice who had ever served in the court, those easy descriptions don't hold over time, but the Gabaitis family had not expected this turn of events.
Everybody assumed that Frankfurter would become the leader of the liberal wing of the court.
This is a historian in a PBS documentary. I'd tell you his name, but PBS, for whatever reason, only identifies him as Simon.
He was a founding member of the American Civil Liberties Union. He was an early supporter of the NAACP. He defended Sacco and Vanzetti, the two immigrant anarchists. He advised Wilson. He advised Franklin Roosevelt when he was governor of New York. And of course, he became almost a one-man employment agency for the New Deal.
Justices Black and Douglas were both famous for their staunch defense of individual rights and liberties, both highly original thinkers who didn't mind being active and forward-looking, easily taking any opportunity to refine and reshape social policy. So yeah, if you'd been paying attention to legal precedent in these matters, it seemed like a slam dunk. But it wasn't. Crimes and Centuries is sponsored by High Health. Okay, I'm just going to say it. Most kids' vitamins are basically candy pretending to be healthy. 2 teaspoons of sugar in a vitamin? No thanks. That's why I switched to Hiya. It's a chewable vitamin with zero sugar and no gummy additives, but it still tastes great. Hunt loves the flavor.
And your neighbor's kids are loving it too, right?
Yeah, I turned Julia onto Hiya, and I checked back with her recently. Her kids love them.
And Hiya's not messing around with the ingredients. It's got 15 essential vitamins and minerals, plus 12 organic fruits and veggies. And now they've got something new, right?
Yep. Are you tired of battling with your kids to eat their greens? Hiya now has kids' daily greens plus superfoods, a chocolate-flavored greens powder designed specifically for kids, packed with 55 plus whole food ingredients to support brain power, development, and digestion. Just scoop, shake, and sip with milk or any non-dairy beverage for a delicious and nutritious boost your kids will actually enjoy.
We've worked out a special deal with Hiya for their best-selling children's vitamin. Receive 50% off your first order. To claim this deal, you must go to hiyahealth.com/COTC. This deal is not available on their regular website. Go to hiyahealth.com/COTC to get your kids the full-body nourishment they need to grow into healthy adults.
Justice Frankfurter's majority opinion in the Gabaitis case basically said that, while he maybe didn't agree with the forced salute policy, states, legislatures, and school districts had the right to enact it. In a 1988 Duke Law Journal, Melvin Yourofsky, a professor emeritus at Virginia Commonwealth University, wrote, quote, "The Gabaitis case presented no new questions to either the court or to Justice Frankfurter. Whether a state could compel school children to salute the American flag had been an issue in 20 states between 1935 and 1940 and had been the subject of major litigation in 7. Prior to Gabaitis, the United States Supreme Court had 4 times upheld state court decisions validating compulsory flag salute laws. Frankfurter, a naturalized American citizen who always took ideals of citizenship and patriotism very seriously, had little sympathy with those who, as he saw it, refused to meet their civic obligations," end quote. He wasn't the only justice who was big on civic obligation. Chief Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes assigned the writing of the majority opinion to Justice Frankfurter. In it, he wrote that the state's interest in national cohesion was inferior to none in the hierarchy of legal values. He added that national security was based on that national unity, and the district's desire and interest to instill patriotism was enough to require them to salute the flag. Justice Stone, the lone dissenter, wrote that requiring the Gabaitis children to say the pledge and salute the flag violated their constitutional rights to freedom of speech and religion, and that no one should be compelled to express beliefs they do not have. Now, on the whole, Americans seemed to like the outcome, and all hell broke out. Joan Biskupic, CNN senior Supreme Court analyst and author of 9 Black Robes, said that when the ruling came down,
Jehovah Witnesses are being pulled out of their homes, pulled from their cars, literally tarred and feathered, pushed to do humiliating things like kiss the flag, forced to drink castor oil, and paraded tied up through the streets of these small towns. There was one incident of somebody being kidnapped and castrated, and newspapers across the country were outraged by what happened.
Lillian Gabaitis saw much more close hand, was regarded as the greatest outbreak of religious persecution in this country in the 20th century.
This was open season on Jehovah's Witnesses. Mm-hmm. One night, my father got a telephone threat. It was really his business associate. And he said, "Wally, if you don't call the Philadelphia Inquirer and tell them you will now salute, there will be a mob coming to trash your store, and we don't know what will happen to you and your children." In the morning, Dad woke us up and told us what happened. And he said to my brother, "Take the 4 youngest out to Grammy and Grandpa, and you and Lillian come in the store." He went to the chief of police, and he said, "Nope, not in my town." And he parked the police car in front of the store all day long. Well, as soon as we saw people gathering together on the sidewalk, we thought, oh, this is the beginning. But nothing happened.
But things were happening now all over the country. A Kingdom Hall in Illinois was destroyed. Another in Maine was torched by a mob numbering 2,500. A witness in Parco, Wyoming was tarred and feathered on June 22nd. He lived for a while, but later died. Five more people were beaten in Rawlins, Wyoming. Another was castrated in Nebraska. Then another was shot in Arkansas. There were a few reports of lynchings. Between 1940 and 1943, it's estimated that some 3,000 witnesses were arrested each year, beaten, sometimes while in custody. It didn't help that, at least once, FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover looked at the witnesses' refusal to salute the flag or support the American war effort as proof of their treason. He spoke of them being a fifth column, a term that is used to describe groups who undermine a nation's interests from within. The tenor of the times is evident in a sampling of newspaper stories written in that brief period between 1940 and 1943. A headline from the Muskegee Daily Phoenix on May 26, 1940. Jehovah's Witnesses threatened with violence by San Antonio mob. The story describes how 40 or so witnesses had been corralled by a mob and were being angrily goaded into saluting the flag. Police arrived to disperse the mob. From the June 27, 1940, Jackson, Mississippi Clarion Ledger, a report that, quote, members of patriotic organizations continue to hold nightly meetings to discuss at length the activities of the group. In the raid yesterday, when batches of literature were said to have been burned by the raiders, the sect members were ordered to leave town, end quote. As a result, two witnesses were taken into custody and charged with vagrancy. And on July 17, 1942, a Santa Clarita Signal story led with this sentence, quote, efforts by a group of Jehovah Witnesses to provoke trouble and violence in Newhall Saturday by returning to peddle their propaganda under the direct protection of the District Attorney of Los Angeles County met with a flat failure, end quote. And in short, the witnesses were labeled traitors. The Supreme Court, the rest of America seemed to say, agreed with them. It's worth noting that the United States was not alone in this. Canada, for example, interred the sect members in camps along with people of Japanese descent. First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt, who at the time wrote a column that appeared in most of America's newspapers 6 days a week, appealed for calm, which might have been helpful, but not nearly as helpful as the pictures that appeared on the newspaper's front pages and in movie newsreels of the German citizenries in thrall with their leader at the time. It dawned slowly that this country was compelling behavior that looked dangerously familiar. As Justice Robert Jackson's biographer, John Q. Barrett, explained, the Gabaitis decision was proving an uncomfortable one.
A defeat in 1940 becomes an ever more controversial topic as the United States is in war against a Nazi power that is built on compulsion and flag salute and Führer salute. And literally the gesture of American flag salute, a hand on the heart and a hand raised towards the flag, looks very much like a Nazi salute.
The Supreme Court began to squirm. On June 8, 1942, in a separate high court case, Jones versus City of Opelika, Justices Black, Douglas, and Frank Murphy noted that they had been on the wrong side in the Gabaitis decision. Unnerved, Justice Murphy told his law clerks to start looking for a case so that the court could revisit the flag salute issue. In 1941, Justice Stone, the only dissenter in the 1940 case, had been elevated to Chief Justice. He had no objection to the request. By then, Justice Black had admitted to not liking the decision, but said he couldn't find anything in the Constitution to invalidate it. Then, after the summer recess, he told Frankfurter he was having second thoughts. Frankfurter apparently sarcastically asked him if he'd been reading the Constitution. No, Black is said to have replied, the newspapers. The court was moving in new directions on many fronts. The judges, who had once been allies, were now bickering endlessly about the role of the court and the rights of American citizens. To add fuel to the flag fight fire, the attacks on the witnesses, consistently violent and reprehensible nationwide, were followed by the news of what was happening to the Jews in Germany. But it wasn't just the Jews, of course, though they were the vast majority of those who were put in camps and executed for their beliefs. Also placed in Nazi death camps were 10,000 Jehovah's Witnesses. As many as 2,000 are reported to have died there. The jurists grew increasingly uncomfortable. Going to a public elementary school in Kanawha County, West Virginia, near Charleston, Marie and Gaithy Barnett, 8 and 11 years old respectively, had been told by their parents to not participate in the morning pledge and flag salute at their grade school. They didn't. They were expelled. For a time, their parents lost custody of them. Cue another legal parade that made its way up the ladder to the Supreme Court. The American Bar Association joined the ACLU in its argument for the Barnett girls. In a weird coincidence, this case is recorded for all time as the West Virginia State Board of Education versus Barnett, with an E on the end of the girl's last name. In fact, they had no such E. Another clerical error during litigation, it's how the case is referred to in the literature today. Back to court. It's been said that the Board of Education's lawyers had believed so deeply in the precedent set by the Gabaitis case that they did little to prepare, which is hard to believe. I can't imagine any lawyer not preparing to argue in front of the highest court in the land, but I digress. In any case, someone thought enough of the case to invite Billy and Lillian to D.C. to again watch their rights being debated. Lillian said in interviews through the years that the kids all sat on the same bench as they awaited their case being called. No one introduced them. The children were all too shy to do it themselves. She regretted that, but she didn't regret how it all ended. On June 14, 1943, Flag Day, no less, the court announced that, in a 6-3 decision, it was reversing itself. Justice Robert H. Jackson wrote the opinion, considered by many to be the most eloquent of his tenure. It read, in part, quote, "The very purpose of the Bill of Rights was to withdraw certain subjects from the vicissitudes of political controversy, to place them beyond the reach of majorities and officials, and to establish them as legal principles to be applied by the courts. One's right to life, liberty, and property, to free speech, a free press, freedom of worship and assembly, and other fundamental rights may not be submitted to vote. They depend on the outcome of no elections. We can have intellectual individualism and the rich cultural diversities that we owe only at the price of occasional eccentricity and abnormal attitudes. When they are so harmless to others or to the state as those we deal with here, the price is not too great. But freedom to differ is not limited to things that do not matter much. That would be a mere shadow of freedom. The test of its substance is the right to differ as to things that touch the heart of the existing order. If there is any fixed star in our constitutional constellation, it is that no official, high or petty, can prescribe what shall be orthodox in politics, nationalism, religion, or other matters of opinion, or force citizens to confess by word or act their faith therein," end quote. Frankfurter stuck to his previous guns. He wrote the dissent, which stands as an impassioned plea for judicial restraint, even to its most extravagant ends. It wasn't a good look. Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by Galatea by Inkit. So many nights I tell myself I'll read just one more chapter before bed, and suddenly it's midnight and I'm still glued to the page.
You're definitely that way. If a story grabs you, you're in it until the very end.
Exactly. That's why I love the idea behind Galatea. It's a reading app with a massive library of romance stories, and they keep adding new ones every week. Whether you're into shifter romance, forbidden love, bad boy billionaires, I mean, whatever your flavor, it's all in there.
Over 30 million people have already jumped on board, right? right?
Yep. And I totally get the appeal. It's a way to actually look forward to that little pocket of alone time. It's something just for you. I've even heard people say they got back into reading because of Galatea. And whatever gets people reading, I support it.
And I'll say, the app itself looks pretty slick. Super easy to scroll through and find something that fits your mood. Right now, Galatea is offering our listeners an extra 25% off on top of an already irresistibly affordable subscription when you go to galatea.com/COTC.
That's galatea.com/COTC to indulge in unlimited stories for even less.
Galatea.com/COTC.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
Confused on where to start with weight loss medication? See the lowest prices available with or without insurance for Wegovy, Zepbound, and more at TryLifeMD.com. 95% of LifeMD patients said starting their weight loss journey was simple. Listen to Tara's story after losing 42 pounds.
You just take your shot. It doesn't feel like you're on a diet. What I wasn't expecting it to do was to shut off the food noise. I had gone from 237 to 195. This was life-altering, and if I can do it, I feel like anybody can do it.
Get your free insurance benefits check in minutes right now at TryLifeMD.com. Nearly 96% of patients said they would recommend the LifeMD program to anyone who wants to lose weight. Get started right now at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.
The battle over the flag and its relationship to free speech got a third round in the Supreme Court in 1989. 5 years earlier, Texas resident Gregory Lee Johnson stood outside the Republican National Convention in Dallas and protested the policies of then-President Ronald Reagan, who was seeking his party's second-term nomination. In doing so, Johnson torched a flag, thus running afoul of a Texas statute that prevented the desecration of a venerated object if such action was likely to incite anger in others. Johnson was arrested, tried, and convicted in Dallas County Criminal Court, fined $2,000, and sentenced to a year in jail. In its first appeal to the Texas Court of Appeals, that conviction was upheld, but Johnson's lawyers weren't happy. They appealed again, this time to the Texas Criminal Court of Appeals, apparently the court of last resort for criminal matters in the state, which reversed the decision. It was the state's turn to be unhappy, and its representatives took the matter all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. There, Johnson's lawyers argued that the First Amendment shielded him from prosecution because his actions stood in for his words that day. They were symbolic of his disdain. Frederick Schauer, a late University of Virginia Law School professor and constitutional law scholar, said the issue wasn't really all that new when it hit courts in 1989.
The issue of whether desecrating the flag or burning the flag or anything of that variety could be prosecuted had been before the Supreme Court on a number of occasions since the late 1960s, but there was really no direct holding on the matter until Texas versus Johnson in 1989.
That came in June of 89 when the High Court, in a slim 5-4 decision, agreed with Gregory Johnson. The majority opinion held that public outrage is not the barometer of whether or when we can throw out our fundamental rights. They also made the rather amusing distinction that burning a flag that is old, the accepted way of dealing with tattered or damaged flags, is considered a sign of respect, and that burning one while mad is not. That is, we can't say one is okay and the other isn't based on our viewpoint when burning it.
In a way, the opinion and the decision merely put an exclamation point on what had been pretty well accepted for the previous several decades. That is, that no matter how much people may be harmed or offended by what people say, and there's no doubt that burning the American flag offends large numbers of people.
Polls taken at the time found that 75% of Americans did not want to go along with the ruling and that their confidence in the court dropped afterward. Congress then stepped in to pass the Flag Protection Act, which made desecration of the stars and stripes a federal crime. The Supreme Court again said, nope, nice try. Various Congress people have tried to amend the Constitution to make flag burning a crime, but that's not gotten much traction over the years. UVA Schauer said the decision's influence is in full flower every day in America.
The impact on American people is largely the impact in terms of a degree now of acceptance that offensive stuff, nasty stuff, hurtful stuff will be a significant part of public debate. It's not the same in every place in the world. American public debate has been significantly influenced by this series of cases, of which Texas versus Johnson may be the most important or most emphatic.
Now, I'm going to take a second for a small aside here. When researching this episode, I found it kind of remarkable to see who exactly had stood fast behind the First Amendment over the burning of the flag. I won't name a lot of names, but I will name two. One was former and now deceased Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. The conservative jurist voted with a majority in 1989. Famously, and many thought incongruously, a friend of Justice Ruth Ginsburg, the staunch Catholic was known to the legal community to be a devotee of interpreting laws as he believed the framers of it wanted. The other is Mitch McConnell, the U.S. Senator from Kentucky and longtime Senate minority leader, a staunch Republican. In a commentary he wrote in 2006, quote, "No act of speech is so obnoxious that it merits tampering with our First Amendment. Our Constitution, our country, is stronger than that," end quote. He then went on at length about how unredeemable he finds those who would choose to burn the flag to be, but then he wrote, quote, "Ultimately, people like that pose little harm to our country, but tinkering with our First Amendment might," end quote. I'll leave that there. Billy Gabaitis died in 1989. His obituary in the Pottsville Republican said he had endured a lengthy illness before dying at age 63. He'd left Minersville in 1944 to do missionary work. 10 years later, he married Sandra Carlson. He spent much of his adult life working in insurance until switching to piano teaching and tuning in his retirement years. His daughter, Marta Tubbs, said her father never spoke bitterly about the case. She said, quote, "It was a chance for him at a young age to show his faith in God. He viewed it as a privilege," end quote. Lillian Gabaitis died in 2014. Her last name by then had long been changed by marriage to Close after she wed Irwin Close in 1954. A fellow witness, Close and Lillian met at a religious convention in Europe in the early 1950s. He'd also been an integral part of the history of their shared faith. In 1934, the Nazis imprisoned Close for 4 months for being a Jehovah's Witness. After his release, he was rearrested for refusing to raise his arm in staunch salute to Adolf Hitler. In an autobiographical essay that was printed in Watchtower magazine and distributed by the sect's headquarters, Close wrote that he witnessed while underground despite being watched constantly by the Nazis. When he refused to pay respect to the fresh swastika-adorned flags of the Nazi Party in the mid-1930s, he was sent to a concentration camp in Esterwegen, Germany, with 120 other witnesses. He was released in late 1935 and conscripted into the German army. He escaped to Spain and then to Holland, where he was arrested on suspicion of being, of all things, a Nazi spy, though he was soon released. He spent the war raiding, his word for clandestine littering of Jehovah's Witness literature throughout Nazi-occupied Dutch towns. He was eventually forced to move on to Belgium, where he witnessed the American liberation post D-Day. In June of 2023, the German Bundestag decided to erect a memorial to the Jehovah's Witnesses who had suffered so deeply under Nazi rule. Erected 2 days before the 90th anniversary of Hitler's regime's 1933 ban on the religious community, the tribute is located in Berlin's Tiergarten, something neither Billy nor Lillian ever got to see. To research this case, journalist Amy Wilson read Peter Iron's The Courage of Their Convictions. She combed newspapers from the 1940s to establish the timeline for the hate speech and hate crimes directed against the Jehovah's Witnesses, She also referenced multiple websites and documentaries that cover landmark Supreme Court decisions and their impact on American society. Crimes of the Centuries is available early and ad-free through Grab Bag Collab. Join us at patreon.com/grabbagcollab to hear not just exclusive content related to this show, but to also get access to several other shows on our profit-sharing network. Unless noted in the citations, this show was researched and written by me, Amber Hunt, and produced by Amanda Rossman and Henry Lavoie. Original music is by Bruce Hunt, Andrew Higley, and occasionally by my son, Hunt Van Benskoten. Other music comes from Soundstripe and Epidemic Sound. If you like the show, help us out by rating and reviewing us on Apple Podcasts. For more information or to recommend a case, go to centuriespod.com.